In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. I don't have to tell you to sit down, you've done it already. Now, some tried and true advice for Lent is to take something up as well as giving something up. We might take up a Lenten study. There's a great one on the parish website by Father Colin, by the way. We might take up a suitable book, a charitable commitment, or just be more serious about prayer and Bible reading. As for giving something up, Father Martin wisely reminded us last Sunday that there's more to it than doing without booze and chocolate. He suggested that we might give up something we've come to overly rely on, something that's become unhelpful for us. And what might that be? The aim of this taking up and giving up is to become more aligned with Christ and his work in our lives as we prepare for the great giving up of Good Friday and the great taking up of Easter Sunday. Today's readings each offer versions of giving up and taking up. The Genesis reading at one level is a fertility story, but at a deeper level, it's a story about trusting God's promises. Abram and Sarai had long been childless, though Abraham had done the handmaid's tale ceremony with his wife's slave girl, Hagar, and bore a son called Ishmael. That's another story. The ancient Near East also knew various pagan practices for dealing with childlessness, and we see a number of these referenced elsewhere in the Old Testament. There were male and female temple prostitutes. There were sacred poles, and you don't need me to tell you what Sigmund Freud would have thought about that. And there were mandrakes and other charms that people used. Stories like the one in Genesis today are a rebuke to this pagan world, outdoing its claim to be spiritually powerful. The God of Israel will secure the legacy promised to Abram. God's blessings to the chosen people will prove reliable. So there's no need for conceiving children on the wrong side of the blanket, as Abram did with Hagar, and there's no need for the assisted reproductive technology of ancient paganism. That whole way of thinking, that whole anxious scrabble to overcome the curse of infertility, has to be given up, while God's promise is taken up in faith. Which of course means that ancient Abraham and elderly Sarah, freshly renamed, will have to draw the curtains and set about trying to conceive a child. Now, I should make clear that this story doesn't represent a promise to every childless couple in our day that if they demonstrate the faith of Abraham, God will bless them in the same way. Now, Scott Morrison might well have thought along these lines, I don't know, when he and Jenny managed to conceive naturally against the medical odds. And they, of course, publicly gave thanks to God. But for others like my wife Lisa and me, the traditional prayer for children offered at our wedding wasn't answered, nor were many of our own prayers later on. No, God's promise to Israel of a physical legacy is a pointer to God's more universal and more eternal promises. And we find these in the New Testament, and not least in today's epistle and gospel. St. Paul in Romans today is explaining how God's promise to Israel is going global, going viral, so that all the non-Jews who were joining the earliest churches could see themselves as sharing in the same promise. So Paul develops the story of Abraham, the father of Israel, declaring that his faith in Israel's God now makes him the father of a universal family in the church. Paul makes his point by relativizing Israel's law in the light of this universal promise. Paul brings the then breakthrough insight, that the Old Testament law, which the Jews honoured and kept, isn't necessary for non-Jews to observe in all its detail. Paul tells us instead that Abraham's faith is what we should be observing. Now, we know the law has its place as a thankful outgrowth of faith, as a guide to thankful obedience to God in God's service, at least for Jewish Christians in those early days. But the law cannot be a proud badge of God's exclusive favour about which anyone can boast. Now, Paul the theologian, Paul the pastor, Paul the proto-bishop, this is his big mission and big task, to make clear that God's blessings, such as the law, must not be turned into markers of insider status. They mustn't be hijacked by the normal way that human beings establish their sense of worth and significance, so that others who are outsiders can be damned and excluded, necessarily so, for this dysfunction to operate. We all recognise this as the way our world goes round. Self-described, law-abiding, respectable people can too easily build themselves up at the expense of others of whom they disapprove. And we see this playing out today in political hostilities around the world and over matters of race and gender. This is why Paul says today that the law is about wrath, because it excludes and it condemns. But he adds, apart from the law, then there can be no such condemnation. See, there's no way to understand and to share in God's promises. There's no way to take our baptized place in God's kingdom of compassion and solidarity and inclusion if we cling to a self-justifying badge of priority status. We recognise this problem in the born-to-rule smugness that's not unknown on the far right. We see it in the grievance-fuelled excesses of cancel culture that are not unknown on the angry left. We see this playing out everywhere in our world today. And all this has to be given up and something more wonderful taken up. And this is the promise to Abraham in its developed New Testament form. Forget the law as a mark of insidership and divine favouritism. Good Friday tells a different story, and we don't understand Good Friday unless we understand how shocking the crucifixion is. Jesus dies on the cross as an outsider to the law. Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree, says the book of Leviticus. Jesus dies on the cross as a figure of scandal, violation of taboo, an anthropological horror show, alongside criminals and other scum cast outside the holy city. And this is about as unlikely a starting place for God's promises being fulfilled as Abraham and Sarah in advanced age setting about conceiving a child. But then Paul proclaims the great game changer. Paul proclaims the resurrection, and he links it to God's creation itself, bringing life from the dead and calling into existence things that don't already exist. Jesus, the lawless outsider, hated and crucified for his offences, for his offensiveness, is vindicated by God and exalted by God on Easter Sunday. The wrath of the law yields to a new creation with no condemnation, with no exclusion, with no contempt from the smugly self-righteous able to interfere, as we discover in Jesus crucified and risen, an unexpected, unprecedented, accessible, welcoming, and liberating version of what righteousness truly means. Because God's righteousness is not against us. God's righteousness is for us. That's what it means. That's what holiness means. It doesn't mean sexless perfectionism remote from a world of hated people. Holiness is God's abiding love and commitment to a beloved human race with the church as its sacrament and witness. So, where the Old Testament promise for Israel's future was secured by legacy in the realm of kinship, the good news of Easter for all humanity is that God secures our future in the risen Jesus Christ. And this comes beyond wrath, beyond death, beyond forgetting. And so, having children isn't everything. And it's certainly not our only hedge against an empty future. We can give that worry up. And the law isn't something we should cling to either, or some contemporary equivalent to it, as if that'll secure us against feeling diminished and against FOMO, the fear of missing out. So we give up relying on what Paul elsewhere calls the works of the law. And we take up faith in the resurrection, faith in that unlikely alternative future that God is making real among us here in church today. And finally, a word about today's gospel. Jesus tells his disciples that they have to give up their thoughts of worldly success and certainly of religious glory and prepare instead for him to be cast out, shamed, and his mission defeated. Because only once the whole agenda of worldly insidership has been shown up for the unreliable sham that it is, will Jesus be raised by God. Now, Peter, who's always a bit of a fall guy in these sort of sessions, always a bit of a useful idiot, Peter can't bear this, can he? And he insists on Jesus fulfilling the normal expectations of worldly success. But Jesus tells Peter, yes, to pull your head in. The teaching that follows about taking up our cross and following Jesus is a shocking teaching for Peter, and it still is today. It's often understood, though, in a much blander way than Jesus intended. We've all been told that taking up our cross means bearing life's burdens patiently and so forth. But we need to remember the offence of the cross. The crucifixion was a carefully designed theatre of absolute defeat which brutally extinguished dignity, agency, and any scope for resistance. Taking up the cross, then, is about giving up on the appearances of worldly success, giving up on satisfying closure and on Hollywood endings, so that going forward with Jesus in the faith of Abraham, we can discover God's future beyond everything we could have engineered for ourselves or even imagined. Now, this is what that sharp warning at the end of today's gospel means. As we give up seeking to save our life by standard worldly means, we'll find ourselves lifted up alive in the resurrection despite everything. Hence, Jesus tells us today that we shouldn't fear the shame of the cross, lest we incur a worse shame when he comes again in glory with the holy angels and finds us busily in pursuit of something else. So, friends, we give up self-reliance as Abraham and Sarah did, preferring to take up trust in God's promises. We give up relying on the law in a self-justifying way because it will never free us from a punishing and punished mindset. Instead, by following Jesus in faith beyond all self-justification, we take up our baptized place in the resurrection and in the new creation. Lastly, as Jesus tells us today, We need to give up obsessions about worldly success or avoiding loss of face, and be ready even to take up a cross of our own. That way, we'll find new life and a secure future with God that we will never get to apart from faith. This is the heart of giving up and taking up in Lent, all of which is visualized, ritualized, dramatized, and celebrated here in our Eucharist. The Lord be with you.